Blog Talk Radio.
This is Chi for Yourself. John's guest today is Kai Whiting, author of Being Better.
Hi, welcome to Chi for Yourself. Great to have you with us wherever you happen to be in the world right now. Today we're going to have a look at Stoicism. Now, back in the day, to be Stoic was to face challenges with what they called a stiff upper lip. When things go wrong, you just suck it up and soldier on. Well, there's a whole lot more to Stoicism than that, and our guest today will unpack some of it for us. Kai Whiting is co-author, along with Leo Kostantikos, of Being Better, Stoicism for a World Worth Living In. And Kai, I don't especially like the phrase self-help, and I know you're not billing this book as a self-help book, but people will come to read it looking for familiar self-help steps to follow. So I want to begin by asking you to talk about how your work and Stoicism, self-help, are different.
Yeah, it's so refreshing that you're so prepared. I really like that. I think it comes across in your questioning, and you really have dug deep. And that's wonderful. It's such a privilege to be here, honestly, John. Yeah, people often think that Stoicism is a stiff upper lip, and we do hear that a lot in Britain, by the way. It's still an important thing in our culture. So you may not hear it much in the US, but we certainly hear it in the UK, and it's something that we're quite proud of. But why, you know, why is Stoicism big S as opposed to little S different? Well, people often thought of being Stoic was being uncaring, and actually Stoicism with big S talks about you need to be caring. And it's not that you have no emotions, you're not sort of a robot or a Star Trek character, right? It's about understanding, okay, I'm having a bad day. It's a bad day. I can't necessarily change that, but I can change my attitude towards it. It doesn't mean that I'm going, right, I don't feel anything. It's like, well, yeah, maybe I am sad. Maybe I am upset. And what am I going to do about it? So it has been kind of hijacked into this 2,000-year-old philosophy, has been hijacked into sort of self-help box. I myself also do the thing with self-help these days because I find it ironic. I don't find that self-help is self-help. The idea of self-help is to help, you know, to learn something to help yourself. Whereas when I found when people read self-help, they have a formula. So it says, oh, John, if you do A, B, and C, you're going to get 1, 2, and 3. Well, that depends, right? How do I know you're going to get 1, 2, 3? You're from the US, for example. I'm from the UK. So if I gave you financial advice, so if you follow my financial advice perfectly, you're going to get as wealthy as I am. So well, none of those things that you have in the UK, we have in the US, and vice versa. So the Stoics aren't really interested in giving you formulaic answers. In fact, they rally against that. They say that you should be able to ask yourself better questions. So it's not, again, not being like, so I have no emotion and not having a formulaic answer. So what does that mean? I take the circumstances as they are, John. I accept them for what they are. And I give myself pause. So like, oh, I am frustrated, but why am I frustrated? And then acknowledging, yes, I'm frustrated. Should I be frustrated? Probably not. And being frustrated, will that make a difference? No. So it's a very solution orientated, but it's not formulaic in the sense that today the appropriate thing might be A, but tomorrow it might be B. So I'll give you an example. You and I both come across a dying person. You're a medical doctor. I am not. In Stoicism, we both have a moral obligation to help that person. If I'm not a doctor, probably the best thing I can do is pick up the phone and call for an ambulance. If you're a doctor, you have a greater physical obligation that you'd actually have to do more than just phone, unless you were very tired. So imagining the day before, when you if you'd come across a man, you would have been on your way to the shift. But as it's the next day, you're on your way back from the shift, it is no longer appropriate for you to do anything more and call someone because you say, right now, I'm exhausted. So you can't say, in Stoicism, you never would say, it is Stoic for a medical doctor to always try to physically save somebody's life by doing A, B, C, and D. You'll say, well, it depends. Are you in the hospital car park? If you are, maybe you are not the best person. Do you reasonably believe that you could make a phone call and someone could arrive quickly? How exhausted are you? So you start to take into consideration the external factors. And also internally how you're feeling and weighing it up. So it's very much, the stiff upper lip isn't like, all right, I don't do anything. It's like, wait a minute, let me think this through. So self-help doesn't work. Self-help is the way it's been forming in the last, say, 20 years, I don't think has much in common with what the ancient Stoics could understand as Stoicism. I don't know if that makes sense, John.
It does, it does. And you show a lot of discernment in your answer, too. I think you and I are old souls. You're given to self-reflection. Today, I'm not so sure that there's a whole lot of that going on. Stoics' possible view... Or the view of Stoicism, I should say, is kind of a life hack in society. We're going to see the days when we have rallies with light shows and maybe walking across hot coals and stuff. Like, is it going to go to that eventually?
I think it's, in some respects, yes. It's just it's easier, isn't it? It's easier to make yourself look good. It's why we call the book Being Better, not sounding better, not looking better, not pretending you're better, but actually being better. So I think what you're talking about is a very sort of tribalistic attitude. Like, I need to be seen as saying the right things. I need to be ticking the right boxes. And Stoicism says that makes no sense. If you're showing your virtue, if you're showing how good you are, you're actually not being that good at all, because there's nothing added. There's no added value in me telling you, oh, John, look how wonderful I'm being. I'm saying all the right things. I'm condemning all the bad people. There's nothing Stoic about that. It's just comfortable, right? The other thing I find really interesting is that we're operating a society of fragility on both sides. It's not a left-wing thing, right? In fact, the left-wing in the US is the right-wing in the UK anyway. So it's quite funny when they go, well, that's the left-wing. Like, for us, it's conservative. Right? And there's some fragility on both sides. They just melt for different reasons. And the idea is that the worst thing that can happen to you is to be in pain. Someone insulted you and you find that painful. And then you want to be seen as fighting the right cause and saying, well, no, you can't say these things and you can't do those things because that might upset somebody. And the Stoics say, well, actually, John, pain isn't indifferent. It's what you do with the pain. It's how you respond to the pain. It's your attitude and how you speak to people whilst in pain that matters. And yes, of course, if I have post-traumatic stress disorder or something very extreme, the best thing I can do is move myself away. But if I wrap myself up in cotton wool, what I do is I prevent myself from working on my character. Because one often, not always, but often works on the character when things are hard, when things are ugly, when things are not as we want them to be. So instead of being the spoiled child of like, okay, remove everybody else away from me, I can't deal with it, they have no right to speak to me like that, Stoicism says, or asks you to think, can I control that person? Am I willing to give up my agency to that person to say they have control over me, that they make me feel bad? Or is it a case like that person can, you know, rant and rave, and I can stand there and say, you're actually incorrect, sir, for 1, 2, 3 reasons, but you're not going to, I'm not going to give you over my sense of peace. And I think we're just too quick on both sides, particularly younger people, to sort of stand on a bandwagon and scream rather than going, is this solving anything? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And you mentioned young people. I'm wondering why are so many young people, it seems, attracted to Stoicism? Is it filling some sort of a void? That would be the logical answer.
I think they're attracted to the life hack Stoicism. I'm not sure how many. I think older people, actually, we have data on this. Older people think you get more Stoic as you get older. Mm-hmm. We actually have data from the modern Stoicism team. So I think young people are attracted to the life hack for many reasons. One of them, undoubtedly, and it's quite cynically on my part, is the fact that Silicon Valley Stoicism is the popular Stoicism, and Silicon Valley has money, and young people at the moment have less than their parents had. And there is a generational gap because of the way that, particularly in the US, the way the US operates with healthcare or the lack thereof and education. So they're looking at, I want to be successful. I want to have money. I want to get out of my parents' basement, right? So they're looking towards Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley Stoicism is offering a life hack. Now, some young people do actually dig deeper and say, actually, all of these things are external to me and I'm feeling lost, but what can I really control? What is virtuous? What should I do in this instance? But I wouldn't say those people are young. I would say most of those people are probably in their 50s and 60s, actually, from having deep conversations. I'm not saying there's nobody who's young, but it's quite rare. The superficial sort of Stoic label, certainly a young label, but the people who really want to dig deep, I don't see that the young people, or many young people, doing that. I would say the opposite.
Oh, really? Okay, I would have thought otherwise. The Stoics did talk about living the good life and how it can be lived if we do the work. What is the good life, and what kind of work do we need to do to realize it?
That's a really good question. So Zeno of Citium said that the good life is not happy, not pleasurable, but flourishing. Being the best human being, not you can be, literally being the best human being. And what does that entail? He says being virtuous. What does that mean? In Stoicism, we talk a lot about what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. To be drawn to what is appropriate and to be propelled by what is inappropriate. So when I took the doctor's case, the virtuous thing to do depends on whether you would be tired that day. So you take self-control as a doctor to say, well, actually, I best not do what I've trained to do right now because I'm tired. It would be inappropriate. And so Zeno said, like, if you can control your mind, if you can reason with yourself and be complete in accordance with those around you, so it's not a case of I believe I'm doing the right thing, therefore I'm doing the right thing. It's I believe I'm doing the right thing because I've discussed it with John and I've discussed it with such and such a person, and we've come to an understanding that this is the reasonable thing to do. Or based on the conversations I've had previously, it doesn't have to be literally right now, this is the appropriate thing. And so Zeno said, every human being has the capacity to do what is appropriate. We may not choose to do sometimes, we may not want to, but we have the capacity to do that. And it was quite revolutionary, really, because he said, you didn't need to be male, you didn't need to be educated formally, you didn't need to be wealthy. All you needed was the desire to move forward, and to move forward in a way that was what they would call pro-social. So there's no such thing, for example, as selfishness and altruism in Stoicism. They will just say, is it appropriate? So you tell people, say, oh, John, that's really selfish of you. You said you had a headache and you didn't meet with Kai, and that was really selfish that you decided to rest instead of having this podcast with Kai. And you'd say, actually, I wouldn't have been able to do my job as a reporter. I wouldn't have done it to the best of my ability. So I wasn't being selfish. Actually, I was doing the appropriate thing because I wanted to put Kai in the best light possible. And to do that, I needed to be able to perform according to my function. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of what every human being can do that. So there's no selfishness in that sense of going, well, I don't want to do it, therefore. It's the reasons behind that. Is it appropriate or not? And there's no altruism, because things like Bill Gates might say, I'm doing it even though I don't have to. And Stoicism will say, if you have to do it, it's not altruism. It's the right thing to do.
Our guest on this Chief for Yourself is Kai Whiting, co-author, along with Leo Costantikos, of Being Better, Stoicism for a World Worth Living In. Zeno kind of got the ball rolling, and I don't know why we don't hear more about him. When I hear the word Stoicism, and I'm probably like a lot of people, the picture of Marcus Aurelius pops up, a name you so often hear. He just happened to be a Roman emperor and the most powerful person in the world at his time of reign, but he seems to be the go-to guy, the figurehead. You think we could ever see somebody like him, remotely close to him, in power again?
In that, I don't see it in terms of an empire, though. I mean, I could say, like, if we take North Korea, I would say that person has, I won't even name him, that person had a lot of power, but not in terms of an empire, no. And I wouldn't say that that individual who runs North Korea is acting with any sense of virtue whatsoever. It is difficult, though. I mean, Marcus Aurelius, I don't know if you saw this piece, because Mary Beard, the classicist from Cambridge, had just said that she didn't like Stoicism because it was fascist. And she didn't like Marcus Aurelius because he basically wasn't very considerate. He was almost as bad as Julius Caesar. And actually, Leo and I responded to this saying, well, it's very funny that you say that it's fascist, because Zeno's Republic is anarchy, which is about as far away as you can get from fascism. And Zeno talked about everybody being at one and being a global community. And the reason why we thought, okay, it is true probably that Julius Caesar, under his reign, as many people died as Marcus Aurelius. The question is that, why are they different to us? It's like, when he had the opportunity to kill people, because he could, he often withheld it and said, no, there's no joy in this. If you find joy in killing people, yeah. He said, it's like you being a spider and finding joy in killing flies. There's no joy or pride in that. So he was very cutting when people said to him things like, oh, well, we can just kill these people. He would say, no, they're our fellow human being. We shouldn't do that. The reason why I think he's so popular is because he's, you know, being the emperor. And Vino, when he said he went anarchy, well, I don't think that went down very well with the powers that be, because he said there should be no rules. That everybody, should, if everybody's living according to reason, then you and I, John, we discuss the rules, and that becomes a rule at that moment specifically. So we don't even need like traffic lights, right? Because he would say, well, is a car coming? What speed are you going? Where are you going? What's your intention? And I don't think that worked very well compared to, say, Plato, because Plato was telling the philosopher king what to do. So I think personally the church felt like it was better to be like Plato and tell the monarch what to do, rather than say, like Zeno, who says, there's no money in my utopia. There's no private property. There's no marriage because no one belongs to anybody. There's like a community feel. And it's not communism. People go, oh, that's communism. Communism is a very 20th century kind of concept. So it's not communism and it's not socialism, but it's certainly not fascism. So, yeah. I think that's why we don't have much about Zeno. I think that's why, because you ask, why don't we hear about him?
It's a great story. Yeah, it's a great story, the shipwreck and all of that, and then his coming of age, I guess, in this way, and becoming the godfather, I'll put small g on it, of Stoicism. And to bring Leo in, your co-author, he served in Iraq, and he mentioned something called a just war theory. Can you tell us more about how he feels about this and what it is?
He tells me he's extremely proud to have served the U.S. Army. He has publicly stated that, so I'm not putting words in his mouth. And he was very pleased to help, you know, his fellow men and women, both those who were alongside him and those that he was, you know, trying to protect. He's not so proud of the policies that put him there. That's what he would say. So in Stoicism, we talk a lot about what's your role. So I gave the example of the doctor. And in the book, we said we have two heroes in terms of war. We have Pat Tillman, who went to war. And we have Catherine Gunn, who tried to oppose the same war. And we said that they're in Stoicism, they're equally heroes. Why? Because each one, according to their role, there was an appropriate act. For Catherine Gunn, who had inside information, it was very appropriate that she tried to share it before the UN was blackmailed, which went against international law. With Pat Tillman, he didn't have that inside information, but he had a strong physique and people liked him. So he felt that he should go to war. In just war theory, it's an interesting one in virtue ethics, because it's always, okay, let's say that the UK did something to the US. At the moment, we say, well, it's reasonable for the US to retaliate, right? In virtue ethics, the answer is, it depends. Is it reasonable now? Okay, what about now? What about now? So you consistently, based on the information that would be coming to you, finding, okay, can we avoid war? Because it's not that... It's not that war is bad in certain, like if it's avoidable and it's just to avoid it, then you should avoid it. So do we have you know, intelligence to suggest that we could actually speak to, say, the Prime Minister? No, he's not listening. He won't talk. Well, who else can we get? Can John go? Yeah, we'll get John. You then go and say, well, yeah, he's willing to talk. Go, no, I want to retaliate. You know, we still have the right to retaliate. Because in certain, there's no such thing as rights. Because there's no laws in the utopia, so it's not a right-based thing. Instead, it's based about what is your proper function or your duty or your obligation. So it's not that I suddenly have a right to then retaliate as an American against, or as the American government against the British government. I have an obligation to protect my people, which is an entirely different idea to I must retaliate because I must restore the pride of the nation, because the nation's a concept, as opposed to I must defend my people. Is the only way to defend, or the best way to defend my people, to retaliate? And that's the that's the question that you ask, instead of under what rules and regulations do I have to tick in order to make this war just? So if they if they attacked me first, if there were civilians that were injured, and in Stoicism it's not like that. It's like, okay, what is my role as a government, as a state, and what can I do to avoid that war? And if I try to avoid that war, would that create, do I have reason to believe that they would actually be worse? And if I have reason to believe, then I should retaliate, but not out of revenge. Revenge is not stoic. It's just because that's the only reasonable response I have left.
Yeah, you just reminded me of an incident during the Cuban Missile Crisis years ago, when a Russian submarine commander was being depth charged by a United States ship who didn't know that he had nuclear missiles on board. And he decided, showed a lot of restraint, and said, no, I'm not going to launch these missiles. I'm not going to start this catastrophe, and ended up saving all of us, really. So it seems like a stoic moment of restraint, you know, even though he had all of this might in his disposal.
I think you've got, that's a really good caveat that you've just pointed out. It's not always what I should do, but also what I shouldn't do. Yeah. So a lot of people think that, Stoics isn't about taking action. But it's equally true that it's about inaction, if that's the appropriate thing to do. So I'm glad you brought that up, John, because otherwise it would make it sound like we always have to act, when actually that's not the case.
Football is a kind of controlled violence. The Stoics had some, pretty violent times. Do you see a connection between the violence of Stoic times and the way people enjoy football today? Is there any, can we make any connect any dots there?
It's funny because I love American football.
I was leading to that.
Yeah. And it was funny because my editor said to me, my son loves it, but if you put one more example of American football in the book, I'm going to scream. I see American football, obviously there are issues with the CTE. I'm not going to say there's none. I do see it as a form of chess. I do see it as a form of strategy. I do think it's the most, for me personally, it's the most beautiful game on the planet. I really like American football. I like Canadian football as well, by the way, which is similar. It's much more historic. It's how it used to be played. And I think we do, as humans, we do want to see strength, and we do have a passion for, like, for example, Epictetus loves wrestling. So I was saying to Leo, should I like American football this much? He was like, well, Epictetus like wrestling. Like, yes, I can continue to like it. but I do think humans, it's not to deny one. I think it is human to enjoy this physical contact in a controlled space, right? Which is much more controlled than the gladiatorial battles. Would I say that it's difficult to say, because you could say, well, if it tampers with your ability to reason, which it would if you have consistently hit on the head, especially when you were 14 and 15, it's actually really hard to argue that it's a Stoic sport. In fact, I think even Donald Trump refused to let his youngest son play American football for exactly that reason, which I found very interesting that he could reason in that respect, and not so much another one. I just found that fascinating. But yeah, I do think that if I'm to deny, for example, if I said, okay, I will never watch football again, my life wouldn't be any worse. But I also think that I as a human being, I need time to switch off. But also, I should be fighting for example, I'm very upset that this whole taking a knee has just shifted from it's right, it's wrong. Rather than saying we have freedom of expression in America, one of the beautiful things about, one of the very beautiful things about the US, I envy you guys, is that you really have freedom of expression. So I couldn't understand for the life of me why, you know, certain individuals in certain teams couldn't kneel when we kneel at church, right? We knew in the mosque, and we knew in a lot of places. And it's more like, okay, come in and have freedom of expression, right? Regardless of what you think that means, that individual should not be treated in that way for kneeling. So I do think the NFL has kind of woken up. I'm actually really pleased that it seems to be more inclusive, but I hope it's not virtue signaling, because I was concerned about, for example, the NFL decided to put the LGBT flag everywhere. And I was like, yes, but unless that actually means change, then doesn't mean much at all. And I always get very sort of nervous when certain companies can put a nice little flag or a nice color on their Twitter feed, but they don't actually do anything.
Right.
So I had an issue, for example, I said, well, why are these drink companies putting in, their flag on there, but still selling drinks in Saudi Arabia? If they really are pro that particular flag, then maybe they should look at that. But I do think the NFL has stepped up to the plate, to use a baseball expression. But yeah, it is a contradiction, and I'm glad that you poked it, because you're not the only one. My editor will love this interview, so I'll tell him that you poked me. I'm trying to get into the second book. I'm like, can we just have one? Like, I promise I'll only have one. But I love the sport. It's great.
You love the Jacksonville Jaguars, I take it. Is there any reason for that? Any reason for Jacksonville or the Jags in particular?
Yeah, I mean, there was a few reasons. The first one was I was 14 or 15, I think, and I wanted a different computer game and I couldn't afford it. And they had loads of copies of Madden 2000 because nobody knows what American football is in the UK. So I just bought it, and all our friends like picked a logo. Pick a logo, that's your team, right? And I just thought it was a cool logo. But later I actually wrote to them as a kid and said, because they were the first team to ban cigarette adverts, but if you remember them, the back of the programs. And they were the first team to say, we won't do that. So I wrote to them and said, that's really good. That's encouraged me never to smoke, which was true. And they went back and they sent me the actual programs. They said, well, thank you very much. Here's the first two programs he ever produced.
Wow.
And I was like, that's so kind. So I then wrote back to them, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And they sent me a letter back, you're welcome. I don't think that would happen these days.
No, very classy. Very classy.
It was great. And then they got fans for life. And then later they became the Union Jacks in the UK. So Jacksonville was the most favoured team in the UK because they've got a fan club called the Union Jacks, which I thought was really clever. They are the most supported team in the UK because they've consistently gone over to the UK and they've actually helped children in deprived areas get access to sports. It's like, that's just fantastic. So yeah, I would own the team. Yeah. I'd have to think about how I negotiate that. But
despite a red card from your mates for going to American football, anyway. One last question, we'll let you go, and it's the obvious one. What is the takeaway from the book that you want readers to be aware of?
I think the biggest takeaway is that the only person who has the answers is you. We say this in chapter one, we don't have the answers. And I really dislike, John, I really dislike the expression, I should put yourself in my shoes. That's a completely pointless expression, because I don't know how big your feet are, but they're probably a different size.
Large.
And therefore, if you put your feet in my shoes, they won't fit. So the Stoics don't talk about empathy. They say empathy is still about me thinking about how you feel, right? And they talk about sympathy, asking how you feel, and harmony, bringing my thoughts and your thoughts together so that we can solve something. So I would say, yes, you have the answers. All I can do is help you ask better questions. That's what Stoicism exists for. If anybody ever tells you any different, which I know some self-help books will do, like if you follow exactly what I say, you'll get these results. To me, there's nothing virtuous about that at all. And it's about knowing your limitations. I give the really sedate example of if, John, how tall are you, by the way?
6 foot.
Okay, so if you told me, Kai, you want to reach that toilet paper off the top shelf, all you've got to do is stand here, put your arms up and grab it. 1 foot, I'm 5 foot five and a half. The fact that I know I'm 5 foot five and a half tells you how short I am. So if I try to grab the toilet paper, it's not that if I believe my arms are going to grow, that's going to happen, which is a lot of self-help. Well, if you just try harder, the Stoics would go, well, is there a step ladder? Go and get it. I don't get the step ladder and then I step up, because then you ask yourself a different question. Like, I want to get that toilet paper. Is it worth getting? Yes. Okay, under these circumstances, it's important. What can I do to get it? Not how can I copy John? How can I follow his advice to the letter? So that would be the thing I would say. And my last message would be simply, I don't necessarily want you to go out and buy the book. What I'd like you to do in an ideal world is ask your local library for a book, because people have lost their job in the pandemic. And I wouldn't want, for the life of me, a person in the US or the UK or elsewhere not to be able to access that book simply because they have to prioritize between something really, really important and reading. So yeah, I don't want you to write. If you want to buy the book, that's up to you. But if you could do anything, it would be to ask your local library to stock a copy.
Where would we find you on social media?
At Kai Whiting, and stoickai.com.
The book is Being Better, Stoicism for a World Worth Living In by Kai Whiting and Leo Konstantikos. Kai, I understand you got another book in your future and that you're going to be bringing that out to us, I hope, soon. And when you do, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again. It'd be great. Okay. I'll have a link to Kai's website at cheeforyourself.com on the start page. Thanks so much for being with us today and for all your support. Greatly appreciated. Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.